This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun-tik. After the US presidential elections 2 weeks ago, many commentators highlighted the role social media played in the spread of misinformation. When you have a sizable portion of an electorate who rely on social media as their primary source of news, what is the responsibility of internet companies like Google and Facebook to take down fake news websites propagating false information? Nikki Cheung, who is a writer and researcher on journalism and digital culture, joins us on the line from the UK to give his take about the politics of misinformation. Nikki, thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
You write about the intersection of media and digital culture, as I mentioned. What were the lessons for you after Brexit and the US elections?
Well, I think one of the biggest lessons I think everybody has talked about is how you can't rely on traditional polls and traditional media solely to kind of imagine what results might be. I think one of the things, it's not that traditional media has no kind of influence, but I think that it's obvious that people are looking to other places for their information. And that is something that I think we haven't been able to capture very clearly yet when trying to make projections in terms of referendums and elections.
How can you have an argument when even basic facts cannot be agreed upon?
So I think if you're talking to politicals, people who work in the political realm, politicians, civil society organizations, activists and things, we need to continue the kind of conversation that we've always had and if not, push forward more. But what I was asking for was that if you're having day-to-day conversations with people, and whether this is whether on social media or in private, offline, I think we need to kind of rethink the kind of language that we're using, because there's no point going up to somebody who already has a certain kind of point of view and worldview about things and going up to them with accusatory terms and calling them names and things. And by names, I mean, you know, even just big words like you're a privileged person as a white man, or, you know, you're racist and things. I think there are ways of calling out racism without using those labels, because those kind of labels make people defensive. And the moment people get defensive, they shut down. And then there's no kind of proper discourse that can happen.
I think we can all agree to be more civil and be more polite in our disagreement. But do you think, a lot of people have used this term, do you think we live in a post-fact age?
So I'm really uncomfortable with that term in general, only because I don't know whether this is the age of post-fact. I think another term that's been going around is post-truth, because I think for many years, and it depends on the cultural context again, traditional media has proven to be, you know, post-truth as well. So if you look at certain kind of regimes, whether authoritarian or maybe semi-democratic, or, you know, depending on how you want to define certain countries, like even in Malaysia, for example, we've had so much discourse about the role of the media, the role that media can play when it's being controlled, not just by ownership from political parties, but also through legislations and licenses and things like that. What I guess makes this a bit more pertinent at this moment is because obviously more people are getting information from social media, and it's easier to get away with mistruth and misfacts from social media because there is no kind of regulatory, there's no way of containing it. And obviously, like I said just now, people are going away from the traditional methods of conversations in terms of politics. So we need to find new ways of dealing with it. And I think that is the junction that we are at the moment.
Because so many people are getting their news from social media, and when we comment online, for example, and we have views that the majority of people, your friends, don't agree with, there tends to be this collective shaming. And then you also wrote this, that you think this is not a good development. But isn't it a good thing that there is some unspoken social rule that you can't make racist or misogynist statements in public?
Yeah, of course. I think we still need to call racism for what it is, and sexism and misogynism and whatever other isms and istics that exists. But at the same time, what I was saying is that some people don't understand these terms, right? So they don't think, a lot of people that you talk to don't think that they're racist. So when you call them a racist, for example, they still understand the kind of shame and the kind of baggage that comes with that term. But because they don't see themselves as one, they react kind of very defensively, and they kind of attack you, right? So if you call someone a sexist, the first response usually you get is, are you a feminist? And that's the end of the conversation. Because obviously, if you are a feminist, you'll say, yes, I'm a feminist. And then they kind of go, that's why you have this point of view, right? And these are people who don't understand that even feminism has different waves of feminism. So we're now in, what, the fourth phase of feminism, for example. So there's a lot of other things that are attached to this kind of terms. Talking to people, there are ways of calling out sexism and racism without using these terms on people who don't understand it. You know, like I said, people who work in the political realm, I don't think that they should be given any breaks in that sense, because they should understand this, because that's their job. But with other people, I think we need to find a better way of conversing, because obviously the way that we've been doing isn't working, right? We look at the way that the world is working at the moment, it's not working. So I'm just suggesting that we might need to kind of reconsider the kind of language of our politics.
Facebook in particular has bore the brunt of the presidential election's aftermath. Do you hold the social network partly responsible for the misinformation that's so widely available online?
I think they have a role to play, but I don't think I'm on the camp of people who think that Facebook or any other social networks need to kind of regulate. Because look, this is the danger, right? So now we're expecting to put trust on an organization who has over and over time proven that they cannot be worthy of our trust to be arbiters of what is right and what is wrong and what is fake and what is not. You know, I think that they do have a responsibility in the sense of making sure that these spaces remain safe for people, that any form of violence in it, whether in the form of verbal or whatever it is, or bullying and that kind of things, are properly controlled. But I don't think that they are the sole, they carry sole responsibility, because I don't want them to be responsible, because then what's the difference than giving, say, a government or somebody full control of any kind of media apparatus and stuff? Because what happens when a new CEO comes in who has different views from what we are calling for, and then what? And then they shut us out. So I think it's dangerous to fully blame. But do they have a role in it? Sure, of course, because let's take away kind of people's posts and comments, and it's hard to kind of regulate that, right? Because it's millions and millions of comments, and people have to be responsible for the things that they say. But do they have a responsibility in kind of blocking out sites that are known to be fake sites? Maybe. I think that they have to think about kind of a way within the algorithm to kind of address these things. I think a few days ago, students from the an article in the Washington Post talked about a bunch of college students who created this system where they would kind of try and verify news stories, right? So they use certain kind of keywords associated with existing news sources and what we understand and accept as legitimate news sources and things, and then try to verify news. That's one way of doing it. I don't know if censorship is the way otherwise.
There is this article in BuzzFeed as well that says the top 20 fake news stories on Facebook generated more shares, likes, and comments than the top 20 stories from real news websites. Would you have a theory on why fake news stories are so attractive?
I think they're so attractive because they're fake. I think some of the things that are most obvious to us are the things that speak out to people the most, right? So just in anticipation of this interview, I've been reading up on articles of interviews with people who create kind of fake news sites. And we're not talking about like The Onion and things which are satirical. These are people who basically create fake news sites to either cause problems or to make some money out of advertising revenue. And they basically found a formula which works, right? So clickbait headlines, sensationalistic headlines and things get people to click. This is the human psyche. It's always been there. It's more pervasive now with social media because it's so much easier. But look, let's face it. People have been reading these kind of things for generations, right? That's why tabloids in the UK work so well. That's why, you know, all these sensationalistic newspapers, you know, The Sun and The Mirror, and maybe even The National Enquirer in the US and stuff, are so popular. I mean, you look at The Sun. The Sun is I think The Sun is the largest read newspaper in the UK, and it's not just, you know, because it's cheap, it's easily accessible. But some of the articles that they write, I mean, the number of lawsuits that they've been facing on a daily basis on defamation and things is well known. So I don't think that this is a new phenomenon, why people like these kind of stories. I think what we need to kind of deal with is how we kind of deal with it in the world of social media.
My guest is Nikki Cheong, a writer and researcher on digital culture and journalism, and we're talking about the link between social media and fake news. We'll talk more after the break, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antik. I'm speaking today to Nikki Cheong, a writer and researcher on digital culture and journalism. And we're talking today about the prevalence of fake news and misinformation on social media. This is in light of Brexit and the election of Donald Trump. So, Nikki, we've been talking a little bit about how information is presented on social media and why some gain more traction and some don't. But in counterterrorism circles, security experts often advocate for the use of counter-narrative against the Islamic State's agenda. When political messaging gets so sophisticated and negative, do you think this is a troubling development?
Yes, I think it's too late. I think that we have seen evidence in the last 10 years, at least, of this being not just used in, not just like political campaigns, right? But we're seeing governments around the world using it as a form of control. So if you speak to people in China, for example, they'll use the word reverse censorship. So basically using this form of propaganda to flood out any form of sounds of dissent, for example. So China is quite well known for its 50 Cent Army, which scholars have revealed that there exist thousands and thousands of posts a day by people closely associated with the government and the Chinese Communist Party, who actually work for them, are on their payroll, who possibly could be doing all of this to get promotions and stuff. And that is the level that we are at the moment. And we're not just talking about China, right? If you read articles in the New York Times, for example, there's been they have evidence of the same thing happening in Russia. Syria has this thing called the Syrian Electronic Army. In Malaysia, we call them the Cyber Troopers. But even the US intelligence, there's been evidence that the US uses, and maybe that's what you're referring to, uses the exact same methods, but not on their own people, but in the countries where they have security forces in there to kind of change people's attitudes towards their military force. So the level of sophistication is, it's way sophisticated, and a lot of money has gone into this, not just in terms of software and things, but also in terms of the actual people who are being paid in some cases to spread this kind of news. Right. So yes, it is. I think it's at a worrying level. I don't think there's enough discussions about it, but I think there's a lot of scholars and researchers at the moment who are trying to kind of figure out how better can we kind of identify these things and use that kind of knowledge to be able to, you know, change maybe people's perceptions and maybe people's understanding of what's happening, so that people be a bit more careful about what they read and what they share. I think that one of the biggest terms for this is astroturfing, right? So trying to kind of mobilizing a certain kind of group of people to speak about certain things which reflect like they're actually grassroots, but they're actually kind of manufactured.
So another thing that confuses me is, even highly educated individuals and elected officials were resharing and retweeting fake news. How would you explain this?
Look, I'm not an expert. I'm not a political scientist. But my suspicion is that highly elected officials and all these politicians are human beings as well, and they are drawn to two things. One is sensationalism. So they receive things that go viral. It's not like they exist in this little bubble where all this information is filtered for them. But I think the second thing is partisanship. I think we're seeing, I don't think that we've, you know, I mean, I'm not a historian, but I don't want to say that we've never been this divisive. But I think we're living in a time when everything is so divisive on partisanship that you can only believe one way or the other. And if you don't, if you don't believe in something else, then you're more likely to believe what resonates with you most closely. You know, some people call it confirmation bias. It's easier to believe things that you agree with, even though it might not be real.
And there are competing research on whether confirmation bias even exists.
Of course, because when you want to do these kind of things, a lot of the research is qualitative, right? So it's based on anecdotal evidence. It's based on bringing a small group of people together and trying to kind of test this. And I think there's a lot of research that's going on at the moment about this topic because of the reason why we're having this conversation in the first place. I don't know whether it's, I don't do research in this area, so I can't really kind of tell you what my suspicions are. But what I think is very possible is, and this is just taking myself as an example, I do get attracted to things that I agree with. I think the difference between me and maybe some other people is that because of my journalism background, I take time to kind of look more into it than just reading one article or a headline, for example, before I decide to share it or before I decide to kind of even kind of engage with the article. And that's just my nature. You know, I'm a bit more cynical than maybe your average layperson.
You work in the media for quite a long time in Malaysia. Have people always been skeptical of mainstream media?
I think people are increasingly skeptical. I think for a long time they weren't. But I think for a very long time, a lot of people didn't know, like in Malaysia, for example, a lot of people didn't know that newspapers belong to political parties, right? So I think in the age of social media, all of this has come out, not just through social media, but because of online news sites and stuff bringing this information to the fore. Previously, people would never have reported it in the mainstream media itself because it does nothing for their reputation. Right. So I think it's people are increasingly aware of this, whether people can pull the correlation between that and control and censorship and propaganda, I'm not sure.
Speaking of propaganda, this is just my own observation, but it seems like far-right political positions are more likely to appear as fake stories. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't know whether that's 100% true. I think stories that are kind of against the establishment of what the status quo is, so things that we're not used to seeing, get shared more only because they're novel. So we've you know, for so many years with the internet and stuff, and I think the left has really gotten a really kind of good use of social media and things to be able to kind of propagate their form of not ideology, but you know, their side of the story and things, that for many years political correctness have kind of suppressed certain kind of voices, right? And for good reason as well. So because we don't want kind of racist, sexist things to be happening, because a lot of these kind of things are involved bullying, they incite hate, they get violent and things like that. But because I think we're seeing a rise of in the right in terms of political movements. So, you know, you're looking at Marine Le Pen in France, you're looking at the return of Pauline Hanson in Australia, of course, Brexit, and then Donald Trump. Because I think leaders are legitimizing or emboldening this form of narrative, we're seeing much more of it. And because now we see much more of it and we haven't seen it for a very long time, that it gets spread more because, you know, again, whether it's confirmation bias and it's appealing to people and people are sharing it more, or maybe it's just new because we've not seen it for a long time.
In response to all of this, Mark Zuckerberg said that Facebook will be reaching out to fact-checking organizations and journalists to improve their news feed and weed out fake stories. I can't help but feel that this is good for Facebook, but it's bad for the economics of journalism because journalists don't get paid from Facebook.
Yes. Having said that, I think the journalists have a role in the public realm to kind of be the arbiters of fact-checking. That's the traditional role of being part of the fourth estate, right? Being the watchdog and things. I hope that Facebook will work with journalists, not as free service, but, you know, find a way in which to engage journalists to do these things. But the problem is once you're under employment as well, then, you know, questions arise, conflict of interest and things. Because, I mean, Facebook had the same issue a few months ago when they had, it was reported, I don't think they ever admitted to it, but it was reported that they had a team of people working the news feed algorithm.
Yep.
And then when they realized that, when the accusations were coming out that they were these were people who were suppressing conservative views, the whole team got disbanded, right? So I wonder whether we'll get caught back in the same situation. So I don't know the solution, but these are potential problems that will reoccur.
Many people today rely on Facebook for their news. Should we as consumers of news and those in the newsrooms adapt or resist?
Yes. I think everybody has a role to play, right? So I think governments have a role to play in terms of educating people. So I think we need more digital awareness, education in schools. I think governments have a duty of a responsibility to make sure that there's better education in schools, which teach critical thinking, For example, I think that the public has responsibility to know that, you know, we are all part of the society, right? So every bit of our action kind of impacts the larger world. And so it's not just a matter of, oh, I'm just clicking or resharing something, but I think we need to take responsibility for it. And we have for many years, right? So that's why defamation and libel laws, you know, libel laws exist, because you can't just go around making things up. For some reason, we've decided that clicking a retweet button or a share button is not the same as things coming out of our mouth, but it is. And I think the faster that we realize that, hopefully, we'll be able to kind of contain this in a bit better.
Do you think the early promise of how social media has helped organize the Arab Spring, for example, it was widely hailed at the time. Do you think some of that early promise has gone?
Yeah, but I think that promise was also kind of a bit hyperbolic. I think it was very easy to buy into that hype. But if you speak to people on ground, you speak to activists who work in these countries and stuff, it's not that they saw a revolution happening, but they would not give full praise to social media. Social media probably enabled certain kind of movements to happen. It was probably easier to mobilize people and bring people down the ground to spread information. But a lot of the sentiments that were already kind of, which are associated with the revolutions, for lack of a better term, were already kind of simmering for quite a long time. I think it's dangerous in any context to give sole credit to one particular thing. So in this case, the internet and social media, because obviously there's so many other things that happens in our life, right? So we talk about this Trump election and we talk about how fake news is spreading. But I think the other thing, it's one thing that is being spread on social media, but I think we also forget that a lot of conversations happen over dinner tables and things. So I think that in itself as well needs to kind of be addressed.
And when you talk about digital culture, the people, I think the way we consume news today is very different from pre-social network. Are people still reluctant to pay for online news today?
I think so.
That's a problem, isn't it?
That is a problem. I don't think that we figured out. I don't think we figured out the economics of anything on the internet, let alone just journalism online. You know, that's why fake sites exist, because it's so easy to make money, right? So if you have a sensational headline, linked to your blog or your webpage with 50 ads on it, one click is going to make you money, right? So these are the problems that's happening, but it's not just a journalism problem. I think this is an internet-wide problem. But the other thing as well is that people have normally traditionally paid for news, but it shouldn't be the domain of the elite. So not everybody can afford to pay paywalls. Not everyone has credit cards. In fact, I would argue that it's people who probably can't afford this who need access more than anybody else. Because that's the only way they're going to gain knowledge. That's the only way they're going to move up in the world. And that's the only way they're going to be able to kind of engage properly compared to people who already exist in the elite, who have all the benefits of privilege of education and, you know, multiple languages and even access to the internet.
This trend of Brexit and then Trump, is it, and the development on social media, is this, do you think it's a wake-up call, or is it a sign of things to come?
I think this is bigger than social media. I think it's a very worrying sign of things to come, in a sense that, so again, it's not just social media, right? So we've seen video clips of people in America, for example, young kids in schools who are using words like build a wall, or send them home. And this was exactly the same thing that happened in UK after Brexit. It's not a social media thing specifically. It's really kind of the state of the world today. The thing that's worrying for me is that it's so soon after the Second World War, and it's so soon after the Berlin Wall has come down, that we still haven't kind of remembered it, even though it was in our lifetime. I think the role that social media can play, and you know, of course, social media has a role in the spread of fake news, but I think social media can be used cleverly in for good as well. And I think that, you know, whether it's the left or whether it's responsible journalists or responsible citizens need to find ways to use the internet to counter this kind of messaging, to spread this kind of awareness, and to kind of reclaim the space a little bit. But I think at the end of the day, it comes down to as simple as, I think leaders need to have the political will to make sure that they maintain safe spaces for all citizens, of everybody. You know, so whether in the in Europe, in America or in Malaysia and stuff, I think people need to have those freedoms that are accorded to them, and anything that infringes it and leads to hate and violence and stuff needs to be stopped.
On that note, thank you very much, Nikki.
Thank you.
Nikki Cheong, the writer as well as researcher on digital culture and journalism. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.